You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2023 on Monocle 24. The US further bolsters Taiwan's defences. The UK enjoys another row over its COVID response, like 2020 never ended. And what are the careers of the future? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Our guests Alex von Tunzelman and Jonathan Fenby will discuss all the day's big stories, and our On This Day historical series will recall what was supposed to be the beginning of supersonic travel for the masses. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by the historian, writer, and screenwriter Alex von Tunzelman, and by Jonathan Fenby, a consultant on China, author, and former newspaper editor. Hello to you both.
Hello.
You have both been, helpfully, for the light introductory banter segment of the programme, doing some globe-trotting of late. Jonathan, you first. You have been to Singapore.
I have been to Singapore for 3 weeks, but I haven't really got anything titillating to tell you.
Really? Because Singapore, I have come to know its airport well en route to Australia, yes. And I do admire its butterfly enclosure and its open-air rooftop cactus garden. I'm not making either of those things up there, unless I was very jet-lagged. No, I'm pretty sure.
That is so.
I'm pretty sure they're both there. And it does enable me, Jonathan, to recall, well, actually to name and shame the delegate at the Munich Security Conference the other weekend who rescheduled us the most often. It was Singapore's defence minister 6 times, but we got there eventually.
Well, I'm glad you got there in the end. People are quite polite, usually in Singapore, but officials are officials wherever they are.
We could not fault him or his entourage on the politeness. I'm sure it's not their fault. They just found 6 more interesting people than me to speak to. Incredible, though, that sounds. And Alex, you have been at a book festival.
I have. I've just been at the Lahore Literature Festival in Pakistan.
That sounds like a hoot.
It was a complete hoot. It was absolutely brilliant. An incredible lineup of writers, you know, Nobel laureate Abdul Razak Gurnah, Booker Prize winners Damon Galgut and Shehan Karuna Tilaka, all sorts of really kind of A-list people, and of course lots of wonderful Pakistani writers as well, Ahmed Rashid and lots of other great people. So it was a complete hoot. What a delight to be there.
And leaving aside the literary festival, would you recommend Lahore, a city I have never visited but have always been enormously curious about, would you recommend it as somewhere to go?
I would definitely recommend it. It has some of the most beautiful sites from the kind of Mughal and Sikh eras, absolutely stunning to look at. At the moment, you know, very unfortunately for Pakistanis, but for travellers, quite usefully, the currency has been devalued to a very significant extent. So it's very, very cheap right now. So, you know, go and put some money into their economy. Go and buy some rugs. Go and do what you would do. But yes, I mean, it's fantastically beautiful. I recommend it.
Genuinely fancy it hugely. As we were discussing before we went on air, I have not been to Pakistan for about a zillion years. I would be entranced to go back.
Well, I was trying to go there once when I was based in Hong Kong and we were visiting China and we were due to go over the mountains, the Pamir Mountains, I think
it is. That sounds about right.
The Karakhan Highway, which we went some way up, and then some people arrived and said, I wouldn't go on any further if I were you. There's a $100 bounty on your heads. So we turned round and I never went to Pakistan.
Well, you're not somewhat insulted by the $100?
$100 is quite a lot of money then. This was 97.
Even so, I'll give you 200 to let me keep my head.
Well, indeed. But we will plough on with the show proper, and we will start with the spectacle of the United States approving a hefty arms package to a beleaguered ally facing the threat of conquest by a nuclear-armed superpower which regards it as a temporarily rogue statelet. Just for a change, however, it is not Ukraine but Taiwan, which finds itself in receipt of $600 million worth of new kit, including missiles for its F-16s. It is not the first time the US has tooled up Taiwan. It is the 9th arms for Taiwan package in President Joe Biden's administration alone, but it does come at a time at which the US and others are trying to warn China off arming Russia. Jonathan, will China find a way to weld those two issues together? I mean, it's a bit of an open goal for Beijing. Even if it does regard them as separate issues, they can go, who are you to tell us can and can't arm?
And the foreign ministry will be banging on about this, I'm sure, over the coming days. But the first thing, the one thing is that the Taiwanese military forces do need reinforcement. Mm. And what they've been subject to in Taiwan for some years now is a series of pushes by mainland China, which I don't think are aimed at invasion, although, of course, there's a lot of talk about that, possibility of that. It's more aimed at wearing out the Taiwanese forces, particularly the Air Force, which has to get up in the air every time Chinese planes approach the center line in the Taiwan Strait. But it's interesting, the Ukraine side of it, because I think, I would say, perhaps hopefully, by China getting involved diplomatically, putting forward its 12-point peace plan and so on, that makes it that much more difficult for Beijing to supply Moscow with arms, I would guess.
Well, one can only hope so. But Alex, since the war, well, the latest iteration of Russia's war in Ukraine started a little over a year ago, it has focused renewed attention on Taiwan. The situations are not exactly the same, but they're not entirely different. A year in, what lessons do we think China would have been absorbing about embarking on an adventure to retake what it regards as rightfully its own?
Well, I mean, they're very different, as you say, partly just the geography mm-hmm. is so completely different that I think it would be a totally different consideration. Taiwan is an island, is much smaller than Ukraine.
And it's quite difficult, the coastline. Landing would actually be pretty difficult. And then if you're going to occupy Taiwan as the reclaimed province of China, of course, you're going to face 24 million people, most of whom hate your guts.
Mm. Well, and as the Russians are learning, that can be quite the obstacle.
That might be a similarity in the cases, yes. In fact. I mean, you know, and that's the problem, of course, is not just conquest, but holding these places, of course, historically quite major consideration. I think, you know, it's sort of interesting watching this because I think historically China and Russia very often, of course, don't get on particularly well. You know, as we've seen sort of through the 20th century, Sino-Soviet split mm-hmm. and so on, there's a lot of division between them. And what sort of seems to unite them a bit is definitely an external aggressor, as they would see it, in terms of somebody like the United States. So, you know, I think that's sort of, and you can certainly see, like, even though I'm sure we can all sit here and think of quite significant differences in the case of Taiwan, Ukraine and all that, you can certainly see why they would sort of see a bit of a parallel. Well, if you know, why shouldn't we do this? You know, I think it's so it's an awkward situation. I mean, I think it's pretty awkward, this arms deal. You know, I can see why they are feeling, well, if you're able to send these arms to Ukraine, then, you know, sorry, if you're able to send these arms to Taiwan, then why aren't we able to send these to Russia?
There's an interesting balance, Jonathan, that the United States is having to tread here. They want to defend Taiwan, but is there a consideration where you could find yourself defending Taiwan to the point that China regards it as an intolerable provocation, therefore making an attack actually more likely? There is also this talk, of course, about the U.S. planning to enlarge its training mission for Taiwanese troops. Yes. There are at present only a few dozen U.S. Marines on Taiwan, mostly doing diplomatic security.
Now, we'll have an increase, I think, in the U.S. commitment to Taiwan, but that's really a function of domestic U.S. politics, where the one bilateral, bipartisan thing that is alive and well in Washington today is opposition to China. Mm. And Taiwan, I mean, I don't think, I have a basic feeling that mainland China, PRC, is not going to invade Taiwan because there are too many downsides to it, and particularly at a time when the domestic economy in China is running into difficulties and the whole setup is not one where you want to launch a foreign adventure, unless, of course, things get so bad within China itself that this seems the way out, or for nationalist reasons, of rallying the people.
Alex, quick final thought on this one. Should Taiwan's allies also have learnt something from Ukraine and Russia? the attitude to Taiwan, especially the United States' attitude to Taiwan, has been governed for years by this thing called strategic ambiguity, that we don't necessarily let China know what our tripwires are and what our responses would be. Is there an argument, if we look at what happened in Ukraine, that that ambiguity is actually more likely to lead to a confrontation? Are we better off by saying to China, in words of one syllable, this is the thing you can't do, if you do do it, then it's on for young and old?
Well, that's one approach, but of course the problem with that is you then have to stand by those commitments.
Indeed. You actually have to do, you may have to do something.
Well, as the United States learnt in Syria, I guess.
Right, yeah. And I mean, that can be quite painful in and of itself. So, I mean, I think you have to think pretty hard before you draw those kind of red lines and really back them up, because, you know, again, if you don't fulfil them, then nobody takes you seriously ever again. So that's, you know, that's a big risk as well. I mean, you know, it's a tricky situation, but I think probably... you know, I feel worried about predicting anything, because I thought, you know, if you'd asked me a bit over a year ago, I would have thought Putin invading Ukraine was such a terrible idea, that so illogical, that why would he do it? You know, that saber rattling was working well enough, and well, look how that worked out. So, you know, it's quite hard to predict exactly what will happen in these situations and why.
But there's no doubt that US-China relations are becoming more and more complex. They're on so many different levels. And, you know, the Biden approach of we are competitors but cooperators at the same time. Xi Jinping, who depends on foreign supplies, for instance, of semiconductors, and it needs to be part of the broader world economy, but at the same time wants to build up China domestically. And I think, I haven't been there for a few years now, but the attitude of most Taiwanese I met when I went to Taiwan was basically, we don't mind being an offshore island, but we'd rather be offshore of California.
Well, let's now move along and contemplate the peregrinations of French President Emmanuel Macron, who is undertaking a brisk four-nation tour of Africa, dropping in on Gabon, Angola, and both the Republic and the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is fairly obviously an attempt to gently reassert French influence in Africa following the recent drawings down of French military forces across the Sahel, though roughly 6,000 French troops remain deployed in the region, and France's outright fallings out with Burkina Faso, the Central African Republic, and Mali. Jonathan, you know France well. You reported from there for many years. You have written books about the subject. How do you see the relationship or the attitude to Africa evolving? Macron has tried quite hard with Africa. This has been definitely a bee in his bonnet. He was in Cameroon, Benin and Guinea-Bissau last summer. What does he want, do you think?
He wants a reasonable, rational, friendly relationship. But the problem is that the countries with whom he wants that kind of relationship don't want that, particularly that kind of relationship with France at the moment. You know, it's the old problem of the colonial power that has gone but has not gone. As an editor of Le Monde said the other day, you know, when you've got 5,000 to 6,000 troops, it's difficult to there on the spot. It's difficult to pretend that you've gone away. Macron wants, I mean, his emphasis on the present trip has been on, so far, has been on the environment, on saving the environment, the jungle in Central Africa. But, you know, you've got a lot of other players in the game now. It isn't anymore France's backyard. You've got Russia, you've got China, you've got domestic governments, including, you know, those governments that have come to power through coup d'etats, largely against the French, who just don't want the French there. And they're a very easy target against which to raise opposition.
And yet, Alex, it would be arguably extremely irresponsible for France to say, well, all right, if you don't want our 6,000 soldiers there, we'll take them all home and see how that goes for you.
Well, I mean, this is a kind of fairly perennial colonial question, to be honest, and is something, you know, having just been in Lahore discussing this and inevitably being asked, you know, should the British have stayed longer in India before partition? Well, you know, not really, because they weren't prepared to commit any more soldiers. They were removing them very fast, is the kind of short answer to that. But yes, I mean, you know, I think these questions of responsibility and continuity are really quite difficult and complicated to sort out, and don't have any sort of easy answer. You know, and obviously the kind of fear, absolutely, as Jonathan mentioned, is that Russia and China are most certainly in Africa in various ways and places. And, you know, do you create a vacuum if you remove those soldiers? Obviously, all of this seeing Africa still as if it is just something to be scrambled for. I mean, there's quite a colonial mentality to all of this, which, you know, which we might sort of try to view Africa a bit differently these days. Perhaps we might try to think of it as states in their own right. I think even Macron said that, actually. He did say we mustn't keep dealing with it as a sort of colonial legacy. Mm-hmm. And I think he specifically said we mustn't think of it as a backyard. It isn't.
Which is possibly, I guess, on this trip why he is branching out beyond former French colonies. He is visiting, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was infamously a Belgian colony, in Angola, which was Portuguese.
Yes, well,
but
I mean,
they speak French.
Yes, indeed. They do. DRC, of course, being, I mean, Congo being a private colony of King Leopold II of the Belgians, and then a Belgian colony, to be a real pedant.
But it is, how far off are we figuring out, though, Jonathan, in both directions, how the former coloniser and the formerly colonised can actually have a mature, constructive relationship? This was a recurring theme at the Munich Security Conference the other weekend, the angst about the global South not coming along with the West in its attitudes to Ukraine. And I did speak off the record to one extremely senior European politician who candidly said, yeah, this is a problem. If I go swanning down there bearing the historical, you know, burden that we tote and start trying to sell to people, well, this is why you should come and help us. Yeah, it's a tricky case to make.
It is, absolutely. And it's made even trickier by domestic politics or, you know, rivalries, civil wars and so on in the region.
Because you don't lose votes by beating up on the former coloniser.
No. And that is very attractive. You can see in places like Mali, that is a great standard to wave, although actually you're at the same time paying the Wagner Group to do your dirty work for you.
Well, indeed. Alex, do you see any differences between France's interactions with its former colonies and the United Kingdom's interactions with its former colonies? Does an organisation like the Commonwealth actually facilitate a more mature relationship?
Gosh, I could write a book on that. That's a very large question. That's a very deep question.
And indeed you should. I for one, would read it.
Just going to go and pitch that one. it's a very complicated picture, and it's nuanced and different. I mean, the French and British empires had quite, you know, both huge, very extensive, and actually almost kind of contemporaneous in their existence as well, but did have quite different relations with their colonised places. I mean, you know, in terms of France, we might think particularly about, and I think this explains some of the continuity, the mission civilisatrice, you know, the idea that this was a civilising mission, sort of very patronising point of view, no doubt, from the late 19th century.
The British had that thing as well, didn't they?
Well, sort of to an extent, but kind of, it was quite different. I mean, you know, I think there was sort of more effort by the French to kind of impose a French culture, whereas the British quite often, particularly in places like India, were pretty much like, look, we'll let you princely states get on with whatever you like, just, you know, keep order and pay the tax, and it's all good.
Learn the laws of cricket.
Yeah, exactly. They care about that.
It'll all be fine.
Exactly. Just play cricket properly. I mean, you know, so I do think the French, and probably because of that sort of investment, La Francophonie and all of this kind of stuff, that has continued, as well as the military presence, has continued very definitely, you know, through the 90s, through the 21st
century. With a
very
important economic element
very
to it,
much.
When colonies in Africa or France were being given independence, they were still expected to be in the French franc zone and basically run their economies for the benefit of France.
Well, we shall see how President Macron gets on in coming days, but we will move along now to British politics, but not before the traditional pause in which listeners of a sensitive disposition may slump against the nearest available wall, then slide sullenly down at muttering despondent imprecations. There is in the UK currently a whole thing relating to the publication of several zillion WhatsApp messages sent by former Health Secretary, later reality show stooge Matt Hancock during the COVID-19 pandemic. Hancock had made the interesting decision to entrust the trove to Isabel Oakeshott, a journalist who has previously demonstrated that she operates according to what might be charitably described as an unorthodox interpretation of the traditional journalistic maxim that one sources are to be protected at all costs. Oakeshott was challenged on her decision to leak the messages by Nick Robinson on BBC Radio 4's Today programme this morning.
My responsibilities, having finished that book with him, are now to the public interest.
Did you break an NDA?
I mean, that's a matter of public record.
And did the Telegraph pay you
far more important? The public interest is far more important.
Did the Telegraph pay you for the messages?
I'm a working journalist.
So they did pay you for the messages?
I'm a working journalist. They did not pay me for the messages. I've been helping the Daily Telegraph with the investigation. You'll see that I've been writing stories for the Daily Telegraph.
Just for clarity, because it is important. In other words, they didn't pay you a sum to receive the messages.
I'm not going to, get into any arrangement I have as a journalist.
Okay, well, money is partially, arguably, a motive. Your belief that
Seriously, anyone who thinks I did this for money must be utterly insane. This is about the millions of people, every one of us in this country, that were adversely affected by the catastrophic decisions to lock down this country repeatedly, often on the flimsiest of evidence, for political reasons.
And yet you helped Hancock write a book justifying all those very decisions.
Why? Because I wanted to get to the truth of it.
Isabel Oakeshott getting somewhat tied up in knots by the Today programme earlier. When we all now finish scratching our chins sagely, Jonathan, the actual trove of texts themselves, I've had a bit of a read through it, and this strikes me as one of those things where there's not an awful lot there we didn't already know or couldn't have guessed.
I think a lot of it we could have guessed, but it's still, you know, it's there.
Mm.
And coming from a relatively senior member of government and to other members of government, I mean, some of the exchanges between ministers are the most interesting, I think, in what they say about the attitude of pretty senior ministers towards the public and the crisis that was in front of them.
Well, this is actually what I do think is the real value of them, Alex, and it is not the value that Isabel Oakeshott was adumbrating there. One of the many reasons that I get irritated with the foil-hatted conspiracy theory tendency who thinks all of human affairs are furtively manipulated by some cabal of sinister geniuses is that that's just not how it works. You know, history gets directed and events get steered by people going, oh my God, what the hell do we do now? And that's what comes through.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in the sort of eternal cock-up versus conspiracy theories of history, it's pretty much always cock-up. Yeah. I mean, in my experience. And, you know, and I think it definitely looks like they're floating. I think also, you know, obviously, as we heard in that clip there, Isabel Oakeshott's very anti-lockdown. That's her perspective. And she thinks that this serves that purpose. But actually, I think what a lot of the messages show is that ministers were pretty, you know, they were not following the science in terms of purely the direction from scientists. They actually were kind of quite cautious of doing what the scientists were recommending. So in a sense, I'm not sure it shows what she seems to think it shows, quite honestly, although I haven't read all 100,000 messages.
Jonathan, is there, though, a dereliction of journalistic propriety here? Because this is one of those things. And there are stories of journalists who have remained loyal to a source up to and past the point where they ended up in prison for contempt of court.
Oh, indeed. I've been involved in some of those cases there where certainly we were taken to court and refused to divulge sources. Yes, you know, what her motivation is in this, I think you can listen to her and nod your head and agree or not agree, and so on. But journalists have to stick with their sources. Now, in this case, can you say that the source, i.e. Matt Hancock, was actually had prejudiced his own position by giving her the 100,000 WhatsApp messages?
It does seem fair to say, Alex, that Matt Hancock, again, I'm choosing my words carefully, may be a somewhat credulous sort of the sort of person with whom somebody billing themselves as a wallet inspector might profitably interact.
I mean, seriously, I'm sorry, a complete fool. I mean, you know, let's not miss this, but
there,
I mean, Isabel Oakeshott, you know, has form. I mean, you know, ask
absolutely.
Chris Hoon and Vicky Price, you know, ask Kim Darroch, ask all this, you know, this has happened a lot. And ask David Cameron about the dead pig. You know, I mean, she's not, you know, she's obviously somebody with very strong opinions, all of this, and, you know, going and doing her thing. But I mean, she's certainly somebody who is, you know, pretty out there with this kind of stuff. And I mean, to entrust her, and I found it very interesting that in one, when she was talking about it at one point, she said when she helped Matt Hancock with his book, she said, sort of echoing that clip before, she said she wasn't paid a penny for her work doing it. Well, I mean, this is a pretty good example of why you actually do need to pay professional ghostwriters, because then you want them to have some responsibility.
Well, we shall see how that story pans out in coming days. There will doubtless be another book by Matt Hancock and further appearances on Dancing with the Whatever. But we shall move along, and there is famously, and I mean famously, nothing that young people are more receptive to hearing than the sage counsel of their elders. Accordingly, the British journal The Idler has polled its readers vis-a-vis what careers they would recommend to those making their first ventures into the world of work. I spoke earlier to The Idler's editor, Tom Hodgkinson. I began by asking how surprised he was that the poll had been topped by scientist.
I was a bit surprised because, to me, idlers are creative types, I suppose. So I kind of assumed our readers would all say, oh, I want to be a musician, I want to be an artist, or I want to be a writer, or something along those lines.
You did have some takers for musician and artist, but did it occur to you that maybe the scientist one might be a bit of a post-COVID-19 thing, that all of a sudden boffins and pointy heads had acquired a luster they didn't have previously?
I think that's probably exactly right, Andrew. Scientists came to the fore during the pandemic so much, and everyone said, you know, believe the science, believe the science. There was a focus on scientists. There was an idea that, you know, scientists really are going to save the world. Also, I think people are picking up that Silicon Valley companies employ physicists, don't they?
I mean, it was noticeable as well that banker polled extremely badly. And again, this may say something about your readership, who are probably not necessarily the idler's target demographic. But that has been for many years in Britain and the United States in particular seen as an aspirational career. Do you think that's changed in some fundamental way?
I think banker's a very strange one. You know, I was reading the 1930s novels of Anthony Powell and or 40s and the snobbish, horrible young men in those books who go to places like Eton, they say, oh, there's only two jobs, lawyer and banker. That's the sort of view of a certain kind of sort of member of the elite, I suppose, in American English society and probably around the world. But most people, I think, have a bit of a distrust of bankers, actually. And it goes back to, you know, you could point to the frequent condemnation of usury in the Bible. Don't lend, don't charge interest on loans. It's an old story, I think. You know, we need bankers. Bankers have always been around. So it does go back a long way. And, you know, there was a lot of banker bashing in 2008 because they're seen as greedy, you know. At the same time, the reality of everyday life, they look after the pension funds and so on. So it's a difficult issue.
I mean, does it therefore perhaps follow that what people are looking for is a job that is in some way admired? Because it clearly isn't all about the money. Banking, at least if you're any good at it, pays a lot better than being a scientist, and it certainly pays a lot better than being an artist or a musician, unless you're freakishly fortunate in either of those fields. Is what people basically want from their work to be looked up to as a result of it?
I suppose so. And, you know, remember, the question we asked in the survey was, what occupation or career, you know, would you recommend to a young person just starting out? Our readers might have looked back on their own career, and a lot of them did actually in the write-up, and look at the mistakes they'd made because perhaps they'd prioritised, you know, security and money over happiness. Personally, you know, the idea is all about, I started it because I didn't want any sort of job at all. you know, readers do write in and say, well, okay, you know, it's all right for, there's a few people who can do this thing of this sort of trick of you know, living by their wits or turning their hobby into something that actually makes a living for them. But they're quite rare, and you know, and there are good jobs. There are people do enjoy their jobs, and our readers, you know, point that out to me.
Well, just finally then, other than your own job, obviously, is there a particular field that you would direct up and coming young folk towards?
I would certainly prioritise meaning, enjoyment and fun over the money. I know so many cases of people who have gone for the money and they get so miserable, you know, and any amount of money doesn't make up for the fact that you're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week doing something that you really hate. I think that's definitely a mistake. You know, the path I've gone down, not that easy. You have your ups and downs. I think the autonomy I have is fantastic.
Tom Hodgkinson from The Idler speaking to me earlier, and we are going to broaden this out to our panel to see what they, or indeed perhaps have, counselled young folk who are asking their advice. Alex, would you earnestly enjoin a young person to get into the historian racket?
Good God, no. I think I sort of have the opposite perspective to Tom Hodgkinson, much as I enjoyed his interview and respect him. I'm like, just follow the money, for goodness sake. You know, do you know how hard it is being a freelancer? You know.
Yeah, because while he said, you know, people are, there's this conventional idea of the person who works 80, 90 hours a week and is earning lots of money but is sobbing with sadness at night, blah, blah, blah. But also a lot of people are doing that because they're earning much, much less.
Well, indeed. So, Jonathan, would you recommend to a young person embarking on journalism at this point?
Yes. Journalism is one of the most enjoyable of professions, I think. The trouble is there are fewer and fewer outlets, and you have to do it in a rather different way from the way I did it.
Well, that is true. I mean, and I would as well, because I have frequently passed on the late, great PJ O'Rourke's summary of journalism. He described it as a way to get paid to do things that you would pay to do if you hadn't figured out how to get paid for doing them.
Well, that's the great Fats Waller quote. Here I am playing jazz, playing the piano. It's what I love doing, and they pay me for it.
What would you recommend then, if not the historian racket, Alex?
Well, I think, to be honest, it just completely depends on the young person in question. People have very different priorities. And I also think something that is, well, you know, good and bad in various measures is that actually now I don't think people expect to have one career for life, mostly. Mm. I mean, perhaps if you still train as something like a doctor, but even then, I know plenty of people who've retrained as doctors much later in life, or as lawyers, or all sorts of things, teachers. You know, I think these days you can expect to have quite a long working life, and you don't actually need to commit completely to one profession young on. And so I think I'm actually pretty much up for young people finding their own way and experimenting, finding out what works for them.
And above all, to find a job, a profession, or several professions, which you enjoy doing.
Well, indeed. And on that relatively upbeat note, Jonathan Fenby and Alex von Tunzelman, thank you both for joining us. And finally, on today's show, our On This Day historical feature reflects on the false dawn, as it turned out, of supersonic air travel.
The world is about to become a smaller place. Soon you'll be able to travel a mile every 3 seconds. Well over 20 miles in just 1 minute.
That was the idea, and for a time, the reality.
The phenomenal Concorde from British Airways.
And let's enjoy a bit more of that fanfare for the future mid-70s synthesizer. Concorde flew for the first time on this day in 1969 from Toulouse Airport. Captain André Turcat, a veteran of World War II and Indochina, at the controls. 4 months before Apollo 11 took men to the moon, this seemed like the 21st century, arriving a few decades earlier than scheduled.
193 feet long, 38 feet tall, with a wingspan of 84 feet. Vital statistics of an Anglo-French lady who was all dressed up and ready to go places on the biggest date of her life.
They don't write voiceovers like that anymore. It had been less than 7 years since the United Kingdom and France had signed the treaty agreeing to work together on the development of a supersonic passenger jet. Nevertheless, by March 2nd, 1969, Concorde was widely criticised as overdue, over budget, a vainglorious boondoggle. There were additional suspicions that, far from opening the skies to the masses in the manner of the Boeing 747, which had made its maiden flight in the United States just a few weeks previously, Concorde would end up serving as a subsidised indulgence of the wealthy. These suspicions would be substantially justified. But when Concorde was towed out of its hangar, only the most doggedly flint-hearted hairshirt wearer could possibly have cared. Even before its mighty Rolls-Royce engines were gunned, Concorde was beautiful not only in how it looked, but in what it represented, ambition, cooperation, possibility.
The all-important final pre-flight check carried out by Chief Pilot André Turcard and his crew went without a hitch. This was it.
Concorde's first flight lasted only 27 minutes and at distinctly subsonic speed. It would not be pushed through the sound barrier until later in 1969, after making its public debut at that year's Paris Air Show and apparently after changing gender.
So, Concorde 001 zoomed up, but the sky wasn't empty. Twin 002 was up there, all the way from England. The supersonic Anglo-French brothers of the air made a thrilling sight. Then it was cheerio or au revoir, whichever language applied. 002 went home and 001 touched down. For everyone, it had been a meeting of Concorde, the aviation thrill of the decade.
The early buzz around Concorde had been promising. Expressions of interest came not only from Air France and British Airways, but from several American carriers, plus Air Canada, Qantas, Air India, Japan Airlines, Singapore Airlines, Lufthansa, Sabena, Middle East Airlines, and Iran Air. A glorious new era of air travel beckoned. London to New York in barely 3 hours, Paris to Dakar in 2.5, Singapore to Sydney in 4.
20 minutes out of London comes the moment some passengers have been awaiting with anticipation. The transition from subsonic to supersonic flight. It's what Concorde is all about. The acceleration through Mach 1, the speed of sound, is accomplished so smoothly that but for the cabin mark meter and an announcement from the captain, most passengers would be unaware of the transition.
Almost all potential purchasers were eventually frightened off by questions of cost, maintenance and noise, and by the pall cast over the idea of supersonic air travel by the 1973 crash at that year's Paris Air Show of the Soviet Union's Concorde rival, the Tupolev Tu-144, derisively known as Concordsky. Only BA, Air France, Singapore Airlines and Braniff International ever actually operated Concorde, and just 20 were built, of which 14 flew commercially, never at a profit. On top of which, a truth usually only spoken in whispers was that, leaving aside the fact that you were on Concorde, being on Concorde wasn't necessarily all that pleasant, certainly not compared with modern business class. More sober reminiscences recall that Concorde had no lie-flat seats or television screens, that the cabin was cramped and the windows tiny, that the noise was barely less deafening inside than out, and that the air on board was infused with a waft of kerosene that not even the lavish sloshing of Dom Perignon could altogether occlude. The beginning of the end was the crash of an Air France Concorde on takeoff from Paris in 2000. Concorde's last passenger flight was a British Airways New York-London service in 2003.
Lifting into the skies with its characteristic elegance and the distinctive roar of the engines, there is no other aircraft like this. There will probably never be another aircraft like this.
Maybe not. One American company, Boom Supersonic, began work on a new factory in North Carolina in January 2023. This will house the production line for the Overture, a swifter-than-sound jetliner designed to run on sustainable aviation fuel. Boom already claims 130 orders and options. The dream ignited on this day 54 years ago refuses to die entirely.
Inside, the world's press wanted to hear Monsieur Turcard's verdict. The big bird flies, he said. It's the beginning of the big work. If that work goes well, Britain and France stand to make £4,000,000,000 and lead the world of civil aviation.
For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Mullett. And that is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Alex von Tunzelman and Jonathan Fenby. Today's show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Andre Nikolai Pamantuan. Our sound engineer was Adam Heaton. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.